Welcome to Bucket List with me, Monique Chambers. Every week, I'll be talking to different business people, artists, sports people, and other personalities about things that they've done in their life and things that they want to do. Join me and dig deep. This is Monique Chambers welcoming you to Bucket List with Barry Hurley. Barry's a sailor and he's single-handedly crossed the Atlantic, but he's done many, many other things. So what did you originally set out to do when you started sailing? How long have you been sailing?
So I've been sailing since I was a small child in Ireland. I grew up on a small island about the same size as Malta, but with only 15,000 people on board.
Nice.
So as kids, we had a choice of going sailing or going fishing, and they were the two options, and I chose sailing. You're not allowed to do both.
Okay. Against the law.
Yes.
You can't fish on the boat, no?
No, it was definitely one or the other.
Right.
So thanks to the support of my parents and all that sort of stuff, I started sailing very, very young. I think I was 5 or 6 when I started.
Okay.
I can't remember, to be honest. It's just always been a part of my life. And then as I grew up, I started to do more and more long-distance offshore racing.
Mm-hmm.
And the ultimate challenge when you start doing long-distance offshore racing is to cross an ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of realized that if I was going to do it, I may as well do it in a way that kind of I won't need to go and do it again. So I decided to go and take part in a race for solo sailors across the Atlantic from the south of England in Plymouth to Newport, Rhode Island in North America.
Okay.
So that's an unusual route. It's the original route that Sir Francis Chichester and those sort of people used in 1962. But these days, if you want to go across the Atlantic in a comfortable way, you go south. You go to the Canaries and you cross to the Caribbean.
Okay.
And you have the lovely trade winds behind you.
Mm-hmm.
The trade winds, so-called, because they allowed easy sailing for the traders in the old days getting to the west. But we were going against that, so we were going on the Northern Circle route. So we were up into the Arctic Circle and down the coast of Newfoundland. So against the wind conditions, against the current, the Mid-Atlantic Stream and the Gulf Stream are against you. And it's also rather unpleasantly cold when you go that far north.
And you're on your own?
Yes, yeah. So one man, one boat, one ocean. That was the catchphrase.
And how do you prepare for something like that? Not just the physical, you know, the strength, the eating at strange times, I'm imagining, and sleeping. How do you sleep?
You sleep never for more than, I chose 13 minutes as my maximum sleep time. So for 21 days, I never slept for more than 13 minutes. And the idea was that it can take about 15 minutes for something to come over the horizon and hit you.
Okay.
So I went on the basis that if I could see nothing on the horizon, then I could get 13 minutes of sleep.
And did you practice that before you got on the boat?
Yeah, it took years. It took a long, long time to get up to it. I had a lot of support from a girl in Southampton University who was doing a master's in sleep deprivation and its effect on people. And so she regularly hooked me up with lots of sensors and all this sort of stuff. And I'd go out and do a race. And then afterwards, we'd sit down and we'd analyze my moods, my strengths, my, mm-hmm. you know, how tired I was, my decision-making capabilities at different times of the day, all those sort of things. But it did take a long time to get to the stage where I could manage it effectively.
And obviously that was in advance of that race.
Yeah, then. It was a couple of years of hard preparation. And the first couple of times you try it are quite scary because the classic problem is hallucinations when you start to get really sleep deprived.
Mm-hmm.
So I certainly had my fair share of hallucinations when I started doing this. But by the time I actually did the race, I was able to manage it all completely.
And so when did you actually do the crossing?
This was May 2009.
Ah, so you've recovered from the 13-minute sleep.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, it took when I finished, it took 6 weeks before I could sleep through a night.
Wow.
Before my body would allow me to just sleep through a night.
And so when you wake up for these 13 minutes, after these 13 minutes, mm-hmm. you had to stay awake for...
Maybe as short as 2 minutes.
Oh, okay, just to check.
But it's check the sails are set correctly, check you're still going in the right direction, check that the weather hasn't changed,
mm-hmm.
and importantly that there's nobody on the horizon. And if all those things are all good, then you can go back to sleep.
For another 13 minutes.
Yeah, but if you know, if something has changed, mm-hmm. then you might be up for half an hour or an hour, or if it starts to get bad weather, you could be up indefinitely.
So what was the worst thing that happened on your crossing?
There was there was probably two things that happened. One was worst and the other one was most unpleasant. So early on, about 4 days out, I had a container of diesel that split. And it spread diesel all over the inside of the boat. So yeah. I got to the stage where every time I'd go inside the boat to try and get some rest, I'd start vomiting.
Mm.
And so for 3 days, I couldn't hold even water. It was getting quite perilous. But after 3 days, I finally managed to, for the umpteenth time, scrub out the inside of the boat with soap and try and get rid of as much of the smell as I could. And I thought the smell was completely gone after 3 days. What actually happened was my brain just got used to the smell. Mm-hmm. And when I arrived in the States on the other side, everybody was like, "You stink of diesel, man." And I thought I was smelling of roses by the stage.
It gave you something to do, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're never bored, to be honest. There's always too much to do. But that was really physically hard, and it took me a few days, even after I stopped getting sick, it took me a few days to get back up to full strength. And I suffered in the race, early on in the race, as a result of that. But then the other kind of nasty part was we had a storm on the Grand Banks of Newfoundland, which, if you've ever seen the film The Perfect Storm, is exactly where that was set. So we were in iceberg territory. The Canadian Air Force had seen over 40 icebergs within a 60-mile radius of me within the last 24 hours. I had no way of knowing where they were.
They don't appear on radar.
They don't appear on anything. It was thick fog, stormy conditions, and the water temperature was 3 degrees and the air temperature was 2 degrees. So I had, with the wind chill, I had ice on my beard and all this sort of stuff. And my muscles slowed down to the stage where I had to crawl. I couldn't stand anymore. My muscles wouldn't move fast enough to hold me upright.
Did you know this kind of thing could happen before you set off?
Yeah, you do prepare for it, but nothing prepares you fully for it, actually, to be honest. If I was going again now, I would be significantly more prepared. Everybody said, "It's really cold and horrible and miserable out there," but until you experience it, you don't really know what cold and horrible and miserable are.
But now I suppose you never get cold.
No, exactly. I do these long offshore races now, and I don't even bring boots. I go barefoot for most of them. And all the young guys are looking at me going, "Well, this guy is crazy."
How long did it take from Plymouth to the States then?
21 days, just a half an hour shy of 21 days.
Okay.
So a full 3 weeks.
Non-stop, on your own.
Day and night.
Everything you had to do, you did yourself.
Yeah.
Were you able to, you said you were very busy, so there's no sort of reading and relaxing. You're pretty much on the go.
Yeah, instead of reading and relaxing, if you have some spare time, it's an unassisted race, which is important to note because it means you're not allowed to receive communications that will benefit you.
Okay, so no weather forecasts,
nothing
like that.
What you can get is the synoptic charts.
The actual
charts of the changes in barometric pressure.
Okay.
At a high level, at an oceanic level, and so basically you have to generate your own weather forecasts from that. So again, there's a lot of preparation goes into. You actually have to create your own weather forecasts based on the raw data, the same raw data that the meteorologists get.
But at sea, I'm guessing it can change quite quickly as well.
The North Atlantic is fairly predictable, to be honest,
okay.
Because the weather in the North Atlantic is born in the Caribbean and then it rolls up along the east coast to the States and rolls the whole way across the Atlantic. So you always know what's coming. It doesn't mean it's nice, but at least, but at least you know what's coming. Whereas here you have weather born literally off the coast of Africa.
Yes.
And it'll arrive here within 24 hours. So it's much more difficult to forecast the weather here, in fact.
And if your wind direction changes, the wind direction doesn't change, it's always, would it always be on your nose, essentially?
It was most of the time. Prevailing winds are certainly against us all the time.
And why did you want to do this? Why couldn't you come the other way? Wouldn't the other way have been easier?
Well, you had to get across first.
And then you sailed back?
Yes. Yeah, so when you get there and you finish partying, you suddenly realise, oh, I've got to get home now.
And you did that on your own, or you had some company?
No, I had some friends. My sister came out to New York, and one of my best friends, Andy, came out as well, and the three of us sailed back to the Azores.
Okay.
My sister got off there, and myself and Andy had a little rest, and then we did the last leg back to Ireland. And what was nice was that we did the opposite of where the island that I grew up in Ireland, was the centre for the immigration at the during the famine time. So 4 million people left the beach in front of our house in a 3-year period. Yeah. You know, 4 million people left this beach heading for America.
Yeah.
And they were all processed in Ellis Island. And there's a set of statues, matching statues, on either end in my hometown in Ireland and on Ellis Island in the States. And so the day that I left, myself and Andy went to the statue in Ellis Island. Mm-hmm. And the day we got into Ireland, we went to the statue in my hometown.
Oh, sweet.
So we got the photograph on both sides. Uh-huh. It was really nice.
And how long did you take getting back? Obviously, it was a bit more relaxed.
Yeah, and we stopped for a bit of a holiday in the Azores. Uh-huh. I think we were almost 5 weeks coming back.
Okay. Yeah. Much more doable.
Yes. But we also had a fantastic time cruising down the east coast of the States from Newport all the way down into New York.
Of course, that would have been even longer. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. And so we sailed down the Hudson River, you know, and people alongside, you know, the New York taxis and people out jogging and all this sort of stuff, suddenly 10 feet away after having spent weeks with no stimulus whatsoever, all of a sudden to be sailing through the middle of Manhattan.
So what did it teach you maybe about yourself, you know, actually achieving it in the end? Is it like, oh, yeah, I've done that, now what? Or has it like, yeah, done that, quite happy?
No, it was a life-changing thing, to be honest. It very much taught me what's important. So when I left, it was kind of, okay, I'll do this for a few months and then I'll go back to corporate life and what I had been doing. And by the time I got back, I decided I had no interest in that anymore and I wanted to earn a living in a way that motivates me personally much more rather than just a way to make money. Mm. So it was about changing life, that everything I do should actually make me happy, as opposed to I'll do these things in order to make the money to buy the things that make me happy. And so part of moving to Malta was part of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, I moved to Malta now 5 years ago, so that was all part of the same life change.
And is that, you're still very much involved with boats?
Yes, absolutely. So there's a series of races around the world. The Middle Sea Race is probably the one that most Maltese people know every October. And I've done the last 12 Middle Sea Races.
Wow.
And over the years, I've managed to do kind of the top 5 or 6 races around the world. And so more recently, I set myself a challenge to do all of them in the one year.
So what, all of the Rolex or all of the...
All of the Rolex series in the one year.
So after Malta, they go to, isn't it Australia?
So starting in Malta last October, we went to Sydney for Christmas and did the Sydney to Hobart race. Then February was Caribbean for the Caribbean 600. Again, another very similar race to the... They're all very similar to the Middle Sea races, just setting.
But you must have different conditions in each area.
Yeah, or maybe not. You know, if the water's still wet and the wind still blows. it can be warmer or colder, but it's the same challenges. So Caribbean in February. Mm-hmm. Now we have the Rolex Giralia, south of France and northern Italy in 3 weeks' time. August will be the Fastnet race off the south of England and the south of Ireland. And then we roll back around to the Middle Sea race again in October.
So you'll be doing, just going to keep going.
I'm right in the middle of getting them all done in 1 year.
So that's the thing on your bucket
list. Which has been a long time goal for a long time as well. Yeah.
Excellent. And what, have you got anything else on your bucket list apart from sailing?
No, to be honest, I think I tend to set kind of short to medium term goals as opposed to long term goals. Mm-hmm. So I'll set a goal kind of for 2 or 3 years away, as opposed to saying in 10 years' time, because what I've learned is life changes so much that there's no point in dreaming about 10 years' time anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But are there things like, I don't know, learning to tango or something that completely, you just think, oh, I'd love to be able to do that, which is, you know, opposite to your, you're obviously a very capable sailor.
Yeah.
Just something completely random that you just think, even if it's to paint, whatever, is there anything you just think, oh, I'd love to have a go, when you're not concentrating?
At the moment, there hasn't been enough time for anything like that, to be honest. One thing I've learned to do since coming to Malta is to kind of change the type of sailing I do and do more relaxing sailing.
Yes.
So I'm much more inclined now to spend a weekend out sitting at anchor and enjoying the wonderful weather here rather than out training. So that, I guess, is quite a change, but still sailing related, I'm afraid.
Do all of the races that you're doing this year, are they all non-stop races as well? The Fastnet and all?
Yeah,
so
you
don't have to do this 13 minutes off thing, though, because there's more.
No,
than...
and they'll be with crew.
Okay.
Except for the Fastnet, which we're doing with just two of us.
Okay.
Again, it's I decided to throw a difficult one in the middle. It wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to just do them all in one year. I had to do a really difficult one with only two people on the boat.
And that's probably not the nicest one either.
No,
is it?
It should be the toughest.
Yes, yeah. Yes. There's something wrong with you.
Possibly.
Do your parents kind of think, oh, what happened? You know, it was when we dropped him. No.
What's interesting is that as the years have gone on, my parents have got more and more relaxed with me doing this stuff. When I started off, they wanted to, you know, they wanted me to call the minute I was ashore and these sort of things. And even on the smaller races when I was younger. And now it's like I go off on a big race and they're like, yeah, whatever.
But you're tracked, I guess. You must have
most
things
of the time,
on the boat that
yeah.
people can see where you are.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
And there's more communications now, say, with air forces and things watching out for
yes,
you.
Yes, exactly.
Hopefully. Okay. So after this year, have you got plans for next year or are you just going to keep doing
this
round?
I've been pushing on my own businesses quite a bit over the last year or two as well. So I think next year is going to be a year where I actually put my head down and focus on getting them to a stage that I'll be happy with and mm-hmm. where I can actually start taking time off again without impacting the business. So unfortunately it all has to be paid for somewhere along the way.
Yes.
And it's time for me to do a little push on my businesses.
So is there a way of being a professional sailor though?
There is, and it's a wonderful lifestyle, but you have very little to show for it at the end and you're only as good as your last couple of performances.
Okay.
So I am in the lucky situation where I've got to the stage now where, you know, I do get brought on for particular races as professional crew.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no interest whatsoever in working
full-time.
As professional crew full time.
So you must just get shipped around and you're good at...
Yeah, I'll come in a week before the race and I'll train up a crew and I'll help them to work together and let them understand my expectations of them and go out and do some training. And then we'll do a race together. And thankfully to date, the owners that I've worked with have come back to me, you know, very happy with the performance that we had achieved. So I tend to be getting repeat business now, which is the best.
Fun bit of it. Mm. And is that sort of how you work your way around the world at these races, or is that's something you just apply?
Those races, it was owners asked me to come and sail with them, basically.
So what advice would you give to people who wanted to get into sailing? What are the, and, you know, eventually if there are people who wanted to cross the Atlantic themselves. What are the sort of steps that you should take?
It's very simple. Just go out and spend time on the water. It's the by far and away the most important thing. And I know people say, well, that's a clique and, you know, a group of people that I don't know any of them. But you'll find that if anybody goes down to the yacht club and just wanders around and says, I'd really like to go sailing. Does anybody need some help on a boat? I guarantee there's loads of people that need you know, they just need bodies, they need hands, they need weight on the side of the boat.
Yeah, to sit over the edge.
And you just get into it and you just do it more and more often.
So as often as you can.
Yeah.
And around Malta has got conditions that are diverse enough to be able to prepare you for this kind of race?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit unfortunate from a racing point of view that there is no wind effectively during the summer. But at the same time, it makes for wonderful using boats in wonderful ways socially, etc. And you'll find that just spending time on boats is just as important as spending time out sailing.
And just getting to know every single inch.
Yeah.
And what about having... Is it more important to you to race on your own boat or it doesn't matter?
At this stage, it's not for me.
Okay.
So the boat that I did the transatlantic race on, I now have here in Malta, but I haven't raced it since 2012. I won my class in the Middle Sea race with it.
Wow, okay.
And then I haven't raced it since then because I've been so busy racing other people's boats.
Wow.
And thankfully, other people can afford much nicer boats than my own boats, so it makes
because
it easy.
Sails are ridiculously expensive, aren't they? If you rip a sail or something, which
and when
happen.
You get into the very last kind of 5% at the top of the performance range, you're going through sails pretty regularly.
Hmm. So, if you had to change a sail on your own, could you have done that?
Yes, you had to. Yeah. Everything that the normal crew of 10 would do on the boat, you have to do.
Okay.
But you do it by yourself and you just do it a little bit slower.
Are there any other things for preparing to do solo? Because it does seem to be a thing that people want to do this racing solo?
It's the ultimate challenge. I mean, it's illegal in an awful lot of places. So in Ireland, where I ended up doing all of my training, it was actually illegal for me to go to sea by myself.
Okay. You can't even, you know, pootle out. You have to be with someone.
Yeah, the theory is that you're not, the theory is that you're not able to keep a standing watch if you have to at some stage go to bed. So you can't be watching the horizon all the time, which is why I came up with the 13-minute thing. And I think that was a reasonable kind of way of looking at it.
And if you, I'm just thinking now, if that was your thing, perhaps you should be writing a book about how to cross the Atlantic solo.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a bestseller though, would it?
Because there aren't
exactly a huge amount of people that really ever get to.
People who like to read about these things.
True.
And sort of they would just know it and be able to regurgitate the facts.
Yeah,
but
perhaps.
Might not be able to actually do it. I mean, yeah, I'd like to be able to stay awake or sleep for 13 minutes and get up and be alert again. Slept for 13 minutes, I'd be hateful. So
another reason to be by yourself, because there's nobody to be hateful with.
But do you like get annoyed with yourself? Do you start singing? What daft
things
do you do?
You're talking to yourself, you're singing, the sleep deprivation brings up emotions as well. So emotions are really high. You have really high highs and really low lows.
Okay.
So there's days when, perfect sailing conditions and you're 2 weeks out there and in fact you're physically exhausted but your brain is working perfectly and you just start crying and laughing at the same time and you don't really know why.
And there's no one to help you prepare for this stuff.
It doesn't happen until you're out there. So
nobody really knows.
I imagine everybody reacts differently. So I had, very high highs and very low lows. But it was no harm. It was fine, and everything went back to normal very quickly after one full night's rest.
But so how did it feel once you'd completed it? Was it wow? How did you feel afterwards?
Little bit of an anticlimax, I would imagine. I didn't focus on it a huge amount because as soon as I finished, I started work getting the boat ready to come back. And then did the cruising down the east coast of the States. There was always next week I've got to do another 200 miles to get to here. And so it just kept on going until I got all the way back across the Atlantic and arrived back in my office.
Yeah. And you're walking down the street thinking, I just crossed the Atlantic single-handedly.
Yeah, a little bit. One of the first things I did was I went to a U2 concert in Wembley Stadium. And there was, I don't know what the capacity of Wembley Stadium is, but I imagine it's 50 to 70,000 people. And I had to leave.
You just couldn't stand that
many. I couldn't
many...
take that many people. I've been a fan of U2 since I was a boy, and I always try and go to their concerts whenever I can. And I had to leave this one because I just couldn't be amongst all those people.
And were there other things that sort of shocked you when you got back, or your behavior had changed? You're saying about sort of doing everything that made you happy.
Yeah.
And what was the very first thing you wanted to do when you got on land? On air.
The first thing is always good food. It always is after any sort of trip like that. The first thing is always good food. So there was a couple of weeks of celebrating and catching up with family and friends. Because don't forget, for the couple of years in the run-up to this, I'd been so focused on preparing for it, I'd effectively cut myself off from my friends and my family. You know, it was a 2 to 3 year project, and it was pretty much full-time for those.
I was just wondering, because you had to train yourself to do the sleep thing. What did you eat, and how do you train yourself as well to...
The food was... It was okay. The difficult part is that when you are up within the Arctic Circle, it's so cold that you're just burning calories, doing nothing. So they were recommending that we take on between 4,000 and 5,000 calories a day, which I was just physically unable to do. I couldn't get that much food into me because you're not necessarily feeling hungrier. And trying to eat an enormous meal just didn't work for me. So I lost a lot of weight along the way. But I always lose the same amount of weight, and it was normal for me, and I knew it would come back straight back on immediately.
So what did you have, like?
But food was mostly freeze dried food, and the freeze dried food industry has come on a huge amount.
Okay.
So I found a fusion restaurant on the south of England, and the guy who owned the restaurant also happened to be an offshore sailor.
Oh, so he understood.
And he was sick of the usual army rations type of thing. And so he basically set his chef a challenge, and he bought a lyophilization machine for his chef, the machine that extracts all the water. And he bought this machine for his chef and say, we need to make restaurant grade freeze dried food.
And then, so how do you prepare it on the boat then?
Just add boiling water.
So you just had to be able to boil water at any one time. On a gas hob, I'm guessing.
On a single gas burner, yeah.
And how did you manage that when you had all that diesel?
It wasn't an issue.
Diesel
won't
catch fire, of course.
Diesel won't burn anyway. but when the diesel smells were there, wasn't any interested in food anyway.
You couldn't go to the front of the boat.
No, because the diesel had found its way through the bilges underneath, and it had just covered the entire inside of the boat.
Nice. And the smell is completely gone now.
It is completely gone now. It was gone a few days after I arrived in the States and realized the smell was still there.
Yes.
But that couple of days, I'll never forget it. It was real, real hardship. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done.
And so, knowing what had happened, would you do it again?
Yes, I would, is the simple answer. I think if I had a choice, I'd take the southern route and go downwind in nice, warm conditions.
Southern softies route.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly. I'm 5 years in Malta now. I'm going soft, you know what I mean?
Well, we hope not too soft that you don't manage to beat all of your challenges. That's been absolutely fantastic talking to you. That was Barry Hurley, who has done lots and lots of races, but he'd single-handedly crossed the Atlantic. Crazy. Thanks very much for joining me, Monique Chambers, on Bucket List this week. Thank you for joining me and my guest on this week's Bucket List. I'd also like to thank Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grec, the engineers, this programme.